Good morning. It's good to see everyone out here this morning. If you've got on pulls on how quick it's going to be before I cry, you get your clocks out now. I don't know how long it'll take, but I'm sure it's going to happen. Right before I went and died, I planned on doing a series on Jesus throughout the Old Testament. I was just going to do the first three or four books, and then we would kind of move that on into Sunday nights and keep doing something different on Sunday mornings, because the Old Testament's pretty long, right? That wear you out pretty quick, wear me out pretty quick too. I guess before we jump into Jesus and Genesis, I'll say again, as I did last Sunday night, how much I appreciate all of the thoughts and prayers and encouragement and all of those sorts of things over these last 2 months. I think I had open heart surgery in 2019, and that was kind of a bummer. I will say this is worse. I have not enjoyed 1 minute since the second I woke up of any of this. And I my first thought was I got to get out of there, and I probably did. I got out of there probably way sooner than I should have, but I say all that to say I appreciate your prayers. I continue to covet and appreciate your prayers. But again, we were going to start talking about Jesus in the Old Testament, and so we'll talk this morning about Jesus in Genesis. Another way I think we probably could have titled this was drinking from a fire hydrant, right? Because there's a whole lot that we could try to cover, and I'm not going to be able to get into as much as we could possibly could, but it is going to be a little bit. But I haven't got to talk in a long time, so just sit back and enjoy, I guess. Where we last left off on Sunday mornings with me was Genesis chapter 3. There at the very end of that chapter, we have God covering Adam and Eve, their nakedness and their shame with animal skins. And it's implied there that God made a sacrifice to cover their sin and their shame. And we call that a messianic foreshadowing. And just a few verses prior to that, that Shane read in verse 15, we have another one of those prophecies. And we're going to see both of these concepts all throughout the Bible, but especially in Genesis. In verse 15, God here is pronouncing curses on man and on woman and on the serpent. And in verse 15, he's focused here on the snake. And he says, I will put enmity between you and the woman and between your offspring and her offspring. He shall bruise your head and you shall bruise his heel. So you just think of that. If a snake were up here now and I stomped on that thing as hard as I possibly could, I might injure my heel, but I'll be okay. The snake, on the other hand, if I did it right, he would be killed, right? The snake would be done. So let's jump forward a little bit to the end of all of this, to Revelation. And I want you to listen to what happens to this lamb who was slain. And again, was is the tense used. That's past tense. And I think that's really important. This lamb who was slain. And the serpent, so we come here to Revelation chapter 5, towards the end of verse 6, he says, I saw a lamb standing as though it had been slain, and seven horns and with seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent out into all the earth. And he went and took the scroll from the right hand of him who was seated on the throne. And when he had taken the scroll, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the lamb, each holding a harp and a golden bowl full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints. And they sang a new song, saying, Worthy are you to take the scroll and to open its seals. For you were slain, and by your blood you ransomed people for God from every tribe and language and people and nation. And you have made them a kingdom and a priest to our God, and they shall reign on the earth. It says, Then I looked and I heard from around the throne, the living creatures and the elders, the voice of many angels, numbering myriads and myriads and thousands of thousands, saying with a loud voice, Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and wealth and wisdom and might and honor and glory and blessing. And verse 13 says, I heard every creature in heaven and on earth and under the earth and in the sea and all that is in them saying, to him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb be blessing and honor and glory and might forever and ever. And the four living creatures said, amen. And the elders fell down and worshiped. And what I'd like to tell you is we're going to spend the rest of the time of me explaining what each of those things mean. But I'm not going to do that. Just keep in mind that lamb that was slain, that prophetic image, that his heel was bruised. But he's okay. So we go over to Revelation chapter 12, verse 9, and we get the picture of this serpent where John records saying that great dragon was thrown down, the ancient serpent who was called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. And I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have come. For the accuser of our brothers has been thrown down, who accuses them day and night before our God. And they have conquered him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, for they loved not their lives even unto death. Therefore rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. But woe to you, O earth and sea, for the devil has come down to you in great wrath, because he knows that his time is short. When the dragon saw that his hand had been thrown down into the earth, he pursued the woman who had given birth to the male child. Keep with me here. We come to that final judgment scene in Revelation chapter 20, verse 10. It says there that the devil who had deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire and sulfur, where the beast and the false prophet were, and they were tormented day and night forever and ever. But in contrast, if we go back to the Lamb in Revelation 21, the next chapter, John is talking about this new heaven and this new earth. And he says, I saw no temple in the city, for the temple is the Lord God, the Almighty, and the Lamb. And the city has no need for sun or moon to shine on it, for the glory of God gives it light, and its lamps is the Lamb. Verse 24 says, by the light the nations will walk, and the kings of the earth will bring their glory into it. And its gates will never be shut by day, and there will be no night in them. They will bring into the glory and the honor of the nations, but nothing unclean will ever enter it, nor anyone who does what is detestable or false, but only those who are written in the Lamb's book of life. So there's the beginning, and there's the end. And so we'll talk kind of about the big picture. What Genesis does so incredibly well is that it paints this big picture of the Bible within just that one book. And the big picture part of it is creation, right? Man messes it up, and so we have the fall. And then God does what God does. He redeems what we've messed up. And he's in the process of continuing to redeem. He's got prophecy. Again, by the end of the third chapter, that there's prophecy and foreshadowing of his redemption plan. And through that redemption, God is restoring. We see a new heaven and a new earth, the way that it is intended to be from the very beginning. Again, God is in the redemption and restoration business. So when we see that storyline played out in epic ways all throughout Genesis. I think a couple of other big picture things is we see God blessing people. We see the word bless or blessing all throughout Genesis. And I want you to think about that. There's lots of different ways you can think about the word blessing. But I think the best way in ancient Hebrew, the one that I like the best, is just a deep fulfillment. Just like, God, I have got everything that I need in you. And we all go searching for that in all kinds of different ways, don't we? And we most of the time, all of the time, we come up empty. Because what we're really looking for are the blessings of God. And what we see in Genesis is God continuing to bless people. But people do what, right? People mess up. They want to bless themselves. God's not good enough. I would like to have that one fruit you say I shouldn't have. And later God blesses Adam and Eve, and we're told that they are to be fruitful and multiply. And after the flood, God tells Noah and his people to go fruitful and be multiplied, to spread out over all of the earth. And what do? They gather for themselves one people, one nation, one tongue, and they say, let's build a tower. Let's build a tower to God. We'll make a great name for ourselves. Let's bless ourselves. Again, it's a concept we see over and over, because what God does in Genesis, he makes it very, very clear that he is the all-powerful, almighty creator of everything. And that he's a good father. He's full of grace and he's full of love and good blessings. But again, as humans, we like to put ourselves in the place of God. We like to do things and take from that tree that makes us see as if we are God. We want to put ourselves on his level. But the good news is again, God is into fixing things. He sometimes lets us run ourselves into the ground in our own stupidity, in rebellion, just to show how much he can restore us. He lets us chase after idols for a while, but he's always quick to restore and redeem and forgive. And there's a beautiful story of Genesis that's played out all throughout the whole of the Bible. If we go back to Adam and compare Adam to Jesus, Rick did that, or Lex did that in class this morning, you'll see a similarity there, but you'll also see a massive contrast that's laid out in Romans chapter 5, where Paul says, therefore, just as sin came into the world through one man, and death through sin, and so death spread to all men because all sinned. For sin indeed was in the world before the law was given, but sin was not counted where there is no law. Yet death reigned from Adam to Moses, even over those whose sinning was not like the transgression of Adam, who was a type of the one who was to come. But the free gift is not like the trespass. For if many died through one man's trespass, much more have the grace of God and the free gift by the grace of that one man, Jesus Christ, abounded for many. And the free gift is not like the result of that one man's sin. For the judgment following one man from one's trespass brought condemnation, but the free gift following many trespasses brought justification. For if, because one man's trespass, death reigned through that one man, much more will those who receive the abundance of grace and the free gift of righteousness reign in the life through the man, Jesus Christ. This one man brings sin into this world. We see that in the book of Genesis. We see sin run rampant. It goes bad really quick. We get the epic story of Noah's Ark, and that's a pretty tough story when you read about it in not such a kid-friendly way. How do you see the gospel in that? In millions upon millions of people dying, most of the animals are killed, God's wrath is on full display. It's a violent story, and it's a sad story. And God cleans up that mess. God rescues them out of that dark, dark world. And this seems very gracious, very merciful, to be rescued, to be saved by God in this situation. We see God's wrath against his wickedness, but we also see his grace. And Hebrews 11 tells us that it's by faith that Noah builds this ark. And it's faith that's turning salvation into salvation. It is a very early, early principle. That's not something that's just introduced in the New Testament. It's something there from all along. We see it in Noah, and we see it in the New Testament. The connection, Peter later makes that connection. And in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 18, Peter says, for Christ suffered once for sins, the righteousness for the unrighteous, that he might bring us to God, being put to death in the flesh, but being made alive in the spirit, in which he went and proclaimed to the spirits in the prison because they formerly did not obey when God's patience waited in the days of Noah while the ark was being prepared, in which a few, that is 8 persons, were brought safely through the water. Baptism, which corresponds to this, now saves you, not as the removal of dirt from the body, but as an appeal to God for a good conscience through the resurrection of Jesus Christ, who has gone into heaven and at the right hand of God, with angels, authorities, and powers having been subjected to him. And I want you to sort of think about it this way. If God is patiently waiting while Noah is building the ark so that they could be saved, what do we think God is doing right now? I believe he's patiently waiting for Jesus to continue to build his church so that many will be saved. That he's waiting, and when Jesus returns, it's a full cleansing. The image here is of the world being washed away of its wickedness, much like the whole world gets baptized, sort of. It's a clean restart, right? But it doesn't take long before sin starts creeping back in. And when Jesus returns, God says that it's not going to be water. That it's going to be a cleansing, purifying fire when Jesus comes. And it's going to eliminate evil for good. 2 Peter, almost all of 2 Peter chapter 3 describes this in better detail. I'll just read verses 12 and 13. It says that we're waiting for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be set on fire and dissolved, and the heavenly bodies will melt as they burn. But according to his promise, we are waiting for new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. The gospel is absolutely in Noah's Ark story. It's on full display. There's a lot of smaller versions that we could get into, but we just don't have time. I want to get into, I think, the most central story of today's lesson, and that of Abraham. And God calls Abram in Genesis chapter 12, the first 4 verses, and in Hebrews 11, again, Abraham is in that hall of faith. It tells us by faith that Abraham goes to where God is calling him. And so we see this calling. What we see the story with Abraham is both a messianic foreshadowing and what Abraham actually did in his obedience, and the prophecy and what God promises to Abraham. So Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 through 4 says, "Go from where your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land I will show you." And you think about Jesus Christ leaving the throne of heaven to come down to this earth, living in exile. Abram, what was to live as an exile, he has to be led by faith to live in this land as an exile that is not his. And verse 2 says, "And I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you so that you will be a blessing." We've talked about that word blessing, "and make your name great." God is making Abram's name great. And I think here it is a beautiful thing. "I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse. And in him all the families of the earth shall be blessed." God is blessing us so as his people we can go and bless others. And this blessing and this covenant being established here with God and Abraham, it's reiterated multiple times, but specifically after Abraham passed this excruciating test of being willing to offer his son Isaac. And that's really what I want to dig into just for a moment. I want to come back, though, to where he reiterates this promise and this blessing in Genesis chapter 22, verses 17 and 18, where he says, "I will surely bless you, and I will surely multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven and as the sand that is on the seashore. And your offspring shall possess the gate of his enemies. And in your offspring shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice." When we go back to Abram in the beginning, Romans chapter 4, Paul describes what Abraham is experiencing and how he is being justified by faith. So this concept of faith equating to righteousness, Abraham believed God and it was credited to him as righteousness. Keep in mind, this again is well before the law of Moses. We'll get in to that next week when we talk about Exodus. And a lot of times when we think about the Old Testament, all we think about is the law. But this is before the law has been put into effect through Moses, and this concept of righteousness by faith has already been well established with Abraham as well as Noah, but specifically with Abraham. Even the sign of the circumcision starts with Abraham. But there are connections and correlations to what baptism are for us in the new covenant. In Judaism, if somebody converts from another religion, if they decide they want to practice as a Jew, the males are circumcised on the eighth day. They would be circumcised and then they could be converted to Judaism. Well, the women went through something different. They went through a ceremonial cleansing, an immersion, a baptism. That was their way of converting to Judaism. So listen to what Paul says in Colossians 2, verse 11. And he says, "In him you were also, you were circumcised with the circumcision made without hands, by putting off the body of the flesh by the circumcision of Christ, having been buried with him in baptism, in which you were also raised with him through faith in the powerful working of God, who has raised him from the dead." Like the whole sermon series probably right there, but let's keep moving. Back to Genesis 14, it's one of those stories there when the storylines of Genesis where things get a little bit strange, right? Abraham has to take his men and his servants, and they go off and they fight this battle because Lot, his nephew, has been taken captive. And there's this battle, and God gives Abram the victory. And after this battle, he encounters this mysterious priest and king named Melchizedek that we find in chapter 14. And Melchizedek is this symbolic kind of type of Christ. There's a lot of mystery surrounding him because we don't know much about him or really where he came from. But it does say that he is the king of Salem. Salem means peace. So he is the king of peace, who is also, it says, a priest of the God Most High. And that's an interesting combination. We don't really see that in the Old Testament very often. A priest and a king having the same role. These are usually two separate people, but Melchizedek is both. And Melchizedek comes and blesses Abram, and he brings out bread and wine. Does that sound familiar to anyone? A blessing of bread and wine. Hebrews chapter 7, if you want to dig into that even further, Hebrews 7 gives an even clearer description of this connection to Melchizedek. But Psalms 10 verse 4 has this prophecy as well. It says, "The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek." When we go back to Abram and Sarah's story, God has promised them a baby, and through them, generations are going to be blessed, and they're very, very old at this point. And they have tried, no doubt, time and time again to have a child of their own, and it's been unsuccessful. And so, how do you get this great nation if you can't get pregnant? And so, Sarah comes up with the idea. Makes more sense to her. Let's use the maidservant. Let's use Hagar to have a child through her. And that's what they do. And we see there man's idea of trying to come up with something better. A different solution than rather regarding or relying on what God is going to do. God, of course, is not pleased with this. He sort of says, "You didn't hear me right. I said Sarah is going to be the one that's going to bear this seed." And we see the birth of Isaac, and that's an interesting story as well. And we've talked about it not too long ago, but think about man's idea of lack of faith and our way of doing things. You could sort of think of Ishmael that way in representing the law and God's will and God's promise. It equals Isaac, which represents grace. And again, Galatians chapter 4, go and read Galatians chapter 4. Paul really illustrates the representation of law versus grace there. But I want to get to Genesis chapter 22 before everybody goes to sleep. We're jumping around. Genesis chapter 22, and I want you to listen to it in a couple of different ways. One, I want you to imagine yourself in this grueling story. Man, and it's a tough tough story. But I also want you listening for all the messianic foreshadowing and all the messianic connections that there is. So Genesis chapter 22, I'm sorry, Kathy, it's long. It says, after these things, God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham, and he said, here I am. He said, take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains on which I shall tell you. So Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and took two of his young men with him and his son Isaac. And he cut the wood for the burnt offering and arose and went to the place which God had told him. On the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the place from afar. Then Abraham said to the young men, stay here with the donkey. I and the boy will go over there and worship and come again to you. And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac his son. And he took his hand and the fire and the knife. And so they both went with, and so both of them together. And Isaac said to his father, Abraham, my father, he said, here I am, my son. He said, behold the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering? And Abraham said, God will provide for himself the lamb, a burnt offering, my son. And so they both went of them together. And when they came to the place of which God had told him, Abraham built the altar there, laid the wood in order to bound Isaac his son, and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then Abraham reached out his hand and took the knife to slaughter his son. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven, said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, here I am. And he said, do not lay a hand on your boy or do not do anything to him. For now I know that you fear God, seeing you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. Verse 13 says, Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him was a ram caught in the thicket by the horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up as burnt offering instead of his son. So Abraham called the name of that place, the Lord will provide, as it is said to this day, on that mount of the Lord it shall be provided. And I want you to think about it. You probably heard it, but if you didn't, God refers to Isaac as Abram's son, your only son. And you can hear the foreshadowing of John 3:16. How long was their journey? It's 3 days. That's pretty familiar too. And if you think about it, in Abraham's mind, he's walking with a dead kid, right? Isaac's already dead. For 3 days, Abram's got to process this. He's wrestling with this for 3 days. As a father, I'm wondering, is his sweat becoming like drops of blood, like Jesus's was? He's got 3 days to think on this journey. They're riding on a donkey? Of course they're riding on a donkey. Because they're heading to Mount Moriah, which, guess what? Hundreds or 1,000 years later is going to be the site of Jerusalem. Maybe even the same exact hill as Golgotha. It's at least in a really close proximity. It's at least where the Temple Mount was. It's right there. It's Jerusalem. Isaac, it's the one carrying the wood for the altar that he's going to be laid upon the mountain. You can see Jesus walking through the streets carrying up his cross to the mountain. And you know, most of the time throughout my life, I always picture this as a father with a young son. But most commentaries believe that Isaac is a young adult. And his dad's an old man. And it's pretty easy bet that Isaac could probably whip Abraham if it came down to it. But here he is, he's bound, and I'm assuming Isaac did this willingly, that he trusted his father. All of this should sound familiar. Abraham's faith in the resurrection. We see faith in the resurrection. We see it illustrated in Hebrews 11. We don't hear it really in the text here in Genesis 22, but Hebrews calls back to Abraham. And he believed, I believe in your promise, God, because we have a covenant. And it may not be making any sense right now, but I trust that you can raise him from the dead. I know you have that kind of power. You think of Abraham's dismay. You promised me a son. You promised to make me a great nation. And now you want me to sacrifice this son. But you can also think of the disciples' dismay, can't you? God, we thought Jesus was the Messiah. We thought he was the one. We thought this was it. What is he doing on the cross? You can see those connections. And God provides a substitute. It's a substitute for the sacrifice. God looks to Abraham and says, you didn't withhold your only son. I know that you fear God, seeing that you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. And we look to God and we say, God, you didn't withhold your only son from us. That's how we know you love us and want to save and rescue us. Let's close here. Skip over a lot of different things. We're going to skip over Jacob. We're going to skip over the Lion of Judah, but go back and read that. I want to tell the whole story of Joseph, but don't have the time or that. But I think that's the best story in all of Genesis. And I'm just going to hit the highlights as we finish up. You no doubt know the story of Joseph. Joseph is a favored and beloved son. He is later betrayed and rejected and hated and persecuted by his own brothers. And he finds himself a servant living in a foreign land. Jesus also says, I did not come to speak to serve, but to serve. We see both are anointed, both filled with the Spirit. There's a line all throughout Joseph's story that says that the Lord was with Joseph. We see them both facing strong and immense temptation. Jesus at his weakest moment ever, being 40 days fasting in the desert, face to face with the devil himself, standing true and holy and perfect. Joseph being tempted over and over by Potiphar's wife and being able to withstand that temptation. Both are falsely accused, though both are holy. Both are arrested. Joseph thrown into the dungeon of prison while Jesus is placed into a tomb. But God calls Jesus out of that tomb and puts him at his right hand. The Pharaoh of Egypt calls Joseph out of prison and puts him at his right hand, establishing authority. And the nations end up bowing down at Joseph's feet. Because of what they've suffered, many, many lives are saved by God. Both demonstrate grace and forgiveness and undeserved kindness that results in reconciliation of relationships. These brothers of Joseph who faked his death, they sold him into slavery, who at least in their minds, if not deserve to die, they come back here to Egypt knowing that they are getting ready to die because they're going to starve to death. And they've came here seeking salvation. And they bow at this man's feet, Joseph's feet. And Joseph forgives. And because of that forgiveness, this reconciliation, Joseph and his beloved father Jacob are finally reunited after all these years. Similar, no doubt, to Jesus and the Father as Jesus ascends back into heaven. And the full circle of redemption really culminates. Really, this big picture of Genesis, through the big picture of the Bible, culminates in my mind in this moment right here. In Genesis chapter 50, verses 19 and 20, Joseph is standing before his brothers now that Jacob has passed, and the brothers are scared, right? Now dad is dead. He was nice to us because dad was alive. Now he's dead. What happens next? It says, Joseph said to them, do not fear, for am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. Finally, we get somebody not trying to take God's place. Even though he's already been established as the second of command in all of the world at this moment, Joseph still recognizes his humble state. He recognizes that this has been God's hand all along. I can't take the credit for God. Even though you planned evil against me, God planned for good to come of it. This was to keep so many people alive, as he's doing now. What Satan intended for evil from the very beginning, God is already several steps ahead. He's already working out good. And we all know the verse. We probably all have it on a pillow in our house somewhere. Romans 8:28. All things work together for good for those who love and are being called according to his purpose. Genesis is a massive reminder, an epic reminder of the truth of that verse. And as Joseph offers this undeserved grace, it results in reconciliation. It results in restoration. We're reminded of a sovereign God who does have it all together. And when we're maybe watching the news, or we're getting scared about this or that, or whatever what's going on in the world, we should remember Genesis and that God's got this. Doesn't mean you sit on your hands when injustices are happening, because we know our God hates injustice. But when you're worried about your own crisis and your own struggles and all the stuff you're going through, remember God's got you. I believe the book of Genesis alone proves that. And we hadn't even got to Jesus in the flesh. He is a long way down the timeline from where we're at right now. But he's still doing all of this work in the beginning. This morning, if you're here and you're not a Christian, the baptismal waters are prepared. We're ready for you to make that decision to be baptized into Christ, to be brought up to walk a newness of life. If you have another need that you would like the congregation to publicly know, please come forward as together we stand and we sing.